About 4 miles from the Capitol building here in Washington, there are a pair of working-class neighborhoods called Cottage City and Colmar Manor. The side streets have rows of tidy little bungalow houses. Bladensburg Road, which divides the communities, is lined with primarily strip malls and fast food franchises. Driving down Bladensburg Road today, there's no sign that one of America's most momentous battles was fought here, maybe because it was a humiliating defeat for the United States. 190 years ago this week, a ragtag assemblage of American militia and veteran Marines tried to hold off the seasoned soldiers of the British Army. They failed, and the militia dispersed in a rout that came to be called the Bladensburg Races. The British entered the city and burned the Capitol, the Library of Congress, the White House, and a number of other public buildings. It was a disastrous day, but there were some heroes. If you look hard enough, you can find one historical marker at the top of a hill on the grounds of Fort Lincoln Cemetery. That's where we are now, joined by historian Anthony Pitch, author of The Burning of Washington, The British Invasion of 1814. What a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
Before we talk about this memorial for the battle in 1814, give us a little bit of background on the War of 1812. It had been going on for 2 years, and we learned in history class that impressment of sailors was the cause. Was that the only or the main reason?
It was the main reason. The British didn't recognize the right of any of their citizens to renounce nationality. And so even those British sailors who had deserted to the American Merchant Marine for better pay and conditions, who had even taken out citizenship in America, they were hauled off or impressed on the high seas. And this was an affront to America's sovereignty and independence. And this was the main reason for going to war. There were others, but this was the main reason.
Did the American people favor going into the war?
The country was as divided as it would later be in the Vietnam War. The Northeast didn't want the war. They were ship owners, shipbuilders, and they knew that this would be the end of their trade. Others saw this, others like Henry Clay of Kentucky and John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, both of whom had been born after the Declaration of Independence. It was too much for them. And they realized that if you are an independent nation and you allow this to go on, you're sacrificing your independence and your pride.
For people living in Washington, the war seemed far away, confined mostly to the Great Lakes in Canada, where the U.S. had invaded and burned public and private buildings in York, now the modern city of Toronto. The British were angry and eager for payback.
The British decided that if they could strike at Washington, they would be able to give them a blow to their solar plexus. It would really be a devastating blow at their morale. And they realized that Washington had no strategic value at all. But it was the capital city. If they could seize the capital, it might even lead to the breakup of the United States.
The British sailed up the Patuxent River and landed at Benedict, Maryland, about 50 miles east of Washington. The American militia wasn't sure how to respond. Secretary of War John Armstrong was positive the British were heading toward Baltimore. Others thought their destination was Annapolis. If the target was Washington, would they come from the north or the south? General William Winder was in charge of the American militia. He sent his troops back and forth, wasting time and exhausting his men. Knowing the British were near, residents of Washington started to panic, packed up their belongings, and headed out of town. The government tried to save important papers, but there weren't enough wagons to haul them all away. Secretary of State James Monroe sent orders to do whatever was necessary to save the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
Stephen Pleasant and a clerk hurried to buy coarse, steerable linen, which he ordered cut and sewn up into book bags, and into these he and others put the originals of, believe it or not, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, international treaties, and George Washington's correspondence, including the historic letter resigning his commission. Now, while this was being done, the same Secretary of War, John Armstrong, who thought they were going to Baltimore, the British, rebuked him for being an alarmist, for thinking the British were on the way to Washington. Now, Pleasant, unfortunately, was not intimidated. He put them into carts, the bags, with his precious cargo, crossed the Potomac River, drove 2 miles upstream of Georgetown, put them into abandoned mill, but then he immediately had second thoughts. He was now opposite Foxhall's foundry, the largest manufacturer of munitions in the country, and certain to be targeted by the British. So he went further into Virginia, got some wagons, came back, loaded them up, and he drove 35 miles west to Leesburg, Virginia, put them in an empty house, locked the door, and gave the key to the local sheriff. And that night he checked into a hotel. So we have those documents today because of the actions of one man who defied the rebuke from the Secretary of War. It's so amazing one man would save those documents.
Bladensburg sits on the Anacostia River, then called the Eastern Branch. The British arrived on the eastern side of the river, just as the Americans were taking positions on the slopes that led west toward the capital. The shooting started almost immediately. Standing along Bladensburg Road was President James Madison. He watched as the American militiamen began to lose their nerve. Company after company fell back. The British pushed up the slope until they met Joshua Barney's men. At the site, Anthony Pitch reads the memorial.
This is the site of the Battle of Bladensburg. It was here that Commodore Barney and his Marines were defeated in the War of 1812. The British moved on to burn the Capitol and White House. Now, I take umbrage at that because it says Barney and his Marines were defeated. They weren't defeated. This was a walkover. The British routed the Americans, the militiamen. But when they came to Barney's redoubt on the top of the hill, Barney and his flotilla men and the Marines, who were well trained, gave as good as they got. Barney's men fought so bravely, they were not defeated, they were captured. They ran out of ammunition and they couldn't reload because their baggage attendees, the people who were in charge of the wagons holding the ammunition, had fled with the wagons and the ammunition. They'd fled in terror. So Barney and his Marines could not fight back. They didn't have the ammunition and they were surrounded. Barney was severely wounded and he was eventually taken captive.
The American forces are falling back. Everything's in disarray. The British were then free to come and do whatever they wanted, and they wanted to make a symbolic statement by burning Washington, the main public buildings. Where did they start?
The British started on Capitol Hill. Those who set about destroying the Capitol arrived in front of these twin 67-foot-high buildings, the Senate in the north, the House in the south, linked not by the dome that we have today, but by a 100-foot-long covered wooden walkway. As they entered, they expected to find what they said were signs of Republican simplicity. Instead, they found evidence of monarchical splendor. They brushed past fluted columns, they raced up grand staircases, under archways into vestibules of vaulted ceilings. It was much more than a building where legislators met. It was meant to symbolize this burgeoning new republic, everything that it stood for, all its creative energy and its democratic principles. So this is what they tried to destroy.
The Library of Congress was in the Capitol.
What was lost in the fire there? 3,000 books were in the Library of Congress. Ironically, most of them were on British parliamentary procedure, and the books are printed in England. One book survived.
The president's wife, Dolly Madison, was at the White House without her husband. The British were approaching. Her aides are trying to get her to leave. What did she do?
Dolly Madison is my favorite female character in American history. The president had escaped across the Potomac River as the British advanced. He agreed to meet his wife in Virginia. All the male guards fled their posts around the White House. This remarkable woman stayed in the White House to save a painting of George Washington for future generations. Who amongst us would do something like that today? This painting of George Washington was by Gilbert Stuart. It was It had been acquired by the federal government in 1800 for the White House at a cost of $800. So at that moment, two New Yorkers, friends of hers, Jacob Barker and Robert DePeyster, came into the White House and asked if there was anything they could do to help. An historian who interviewed one of them shortly afterwards recorded that she said, "Save that painting. Under no circumstances allow it to fall into the hands of the British." When she saw that her slave, Paul Jennings, was taking too long to unscrew the frame from the canvas, frame from the wall, she told him to break the wood and take out the linen canvas. Now, fortunately, at that moment, French John, in charge of all the people working in the White House, came into the room and, seeing the potential for permanent damage, told the slave to stop. So French John, with Dolly's approval, took out his knife and, according to tradition, cut this heavyweight English tulle fabric out of the frame. It was gigantic, 95 inches long, 59 and 3/4 inches wide. He gave it to one of the New Yorkers, who started to roll it up, and still stopped by the Frenchman for fear the paint would crack. They put it flat in a wagon, drove 2 miles through Georgetown into the countryside, where they left it with a farmer they stayed with overnight. That night, the British burned the White House. Every single thing was destroyed inside.
The British stayed for 24 hours. When they left, the Americans had to try and patch together their government. What goes through your mind as we sit here on the site of the Battle of Bladensburg, August 1814, August 2004, and we're overlooking a Capitol building that is surrounded by security and cement, and a White House that is surrounded by security and cement, and a target for forces that would destroy it?
I think that the lesson to be learned from 1812, or 1814 when the invasion actually took place, do not invest enormous power in a few people. The Secretary of War had this enormous power in 1814, and with all that intelligence that was not available to other people, he refused to believe the British Army was going to take Washington. Until the last minute, he thought it was going to be Baltimore. Had there been a diffusion of power, there would have been questions asked and different analyses made. This is exactly history repeating itself today, in my opinion. This whole debate now about whether to have somebody on the top of all the intelligence organizations really harks back to 1814, because in both cases you had the threat of something terrible happening to the people in the capital of this great nation, and you're relying on a few people at the top to get you out of the mess.
Anthony Pitch is the author of The Burning of Washington, The British Invasion of 1814. Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information about the Battle of Bladensburg and the burning of buildings in Washington, please go to our website, npr.org. You'll find more details about the day's events, an extended interview with Anthony Pitch, a photo gallery, Commodore Barney's post-battle report, and other resources about the War of 1812.